Make a couple of announcements. A couple of weeks ago, I know some of you may not have been able to be here, but during the Bible class period, we kind of took a break from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and we talked about conversion and talked about the nature of conversion and some questions that often come up with our children in a very practical way about becoming a Christian, how to address some of those things. I know that sometimes it's very difficult as our kids are growing up to know, okay, are they ready or not? And there's certain questions to ask. And even for ourselves, I've known people that have looked back on what they thought was their conversion and have questioned that. Those are all sometimes heart-wrenching questions, but good questions in the long run. If you're interested in that, there's two things. I do have material. I'd be happy to email you. But also, even though we don't normally put the Bible classes on CD and put them in the back, I know that we can't. That was recorded, I think, Gary, that Bible class period. Yeah, I know it was because you made a copy for somebody the other day. But we can get that to you because I've had several of you say, hey, I'd really like to listen to that again. Now, I warn you, you know, when we have discussion, you guys aren't mic'd the way I am. And so it may be a little fainter when somebody's talking, but I think you'll still be able to make it out, and there was some good discussion, I thought, in that class. So if you're interested, let me know, or let Gary Brown know, and we'll try to get that to you. We are in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 today, and we're going to continue on here as we think about the resurrection. Find my little deal here. There it is. And just try to keep the flow of this context in mind as we move through. And so let's review just a little bit to make sure we're all going the direction we need to go. So the issue that Paul is dealing with is the question of the future bodily resurrection, which has been promised to God's people. Jesus says in John 5:28 and 29 that both the righteous and the wicked will be raised. And he's very emphatic about that. He says it's going to happen at the same time. It's going to be the same hour. But in 1 Corinthians 15, whose resurrection does Paul seem to be focused on? The faithful or the unfaithful? Yeah, the faithful, the righteous, God's people. So that's just the focus of the discussion because that's where the question really was. And I've mentioned to you, is the idea of a future bodily resurrection, just the idea of resurrection, unique for the most part to Christianity? It is. And I had mentioned to you before, but it's important when you read through 1 Corinthians chapter 15 to understand their time and what was going on, because I think at least it enriches our appreciation for why there's this emphasis and why there would have even been a question. You might be asking, why was there even a question? And we've mentioned this, but when you look at the philosophies that were modernly accepted, especially if you think about the church at Corinth, when you look at the church at Corinth and you begin to maybe do some, if you were to do some research about Corinth and what would have been the, you know, majority view outside of Christianity, you would have had all kinds of different philosophies that would have emphasized that there's not going to be a resurrection. It's getting the soul, you know, Platonism and things like that. Plato would have said, let's get the soul away from the body and not mess with the body anymore. Okay, you know, material things are not so good. We want to get away from that. And yet, when you think about the heart of the gospel, what does Paul say in the first 11 verses of 1 Corinthians 15, especially verses 1 through 4, is the gospel as far as the facts that we believe, the truths, the center of it. What does he mention? Death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And that's not all there is to the gospel. But that is the heart of the gospel. I mean, if you don't have that, you don't have the gospel. Okay? So that's what he's saying. So even when you think about what you believe in becoming a Christian, that would have been far different than other thoughts during the first century and even other thoughts today, right? So the idea of resurrection, in this case, the resurrection of Christ, is central to the gospel. But in a sense, Paul's coming in the back door because you may be saying, well, wait a minute, were they really questioning the resurrection of Jesus? No, not necessarily, but that is where he believes this would end up if they were logically consistent. Because in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 in verse 12, what does he tie together? Anybody? Yes, and this is critical. I've emphasized it, but I don't think you can overemphasize it. Verse 12 in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, when he says, "Now, if Christ is preached," now that's what the first 11 verses have been about. And let me emphasize this. There's no way we get to say, well, there's not really a, we believe in the future bodily resurrection, but there's no connection between our resurrection and His resurrection. Well, first of all, if He didn't have His resurrection, we wouldn't be having our resurrection. Secondly, there is an inseparable connection between what we know about Jesus' resurrection body and about the future resurrection. Okay, so he says in the first 11 verses he deals with this. Then in verse 12 he says, "Now if Christ is preached that He has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say that there is no resurrection of the dead?" So you see what he's doing there. He's saying, you know, in effect you're saying there's no resurrection at all. Now you may be saying you believe in the resurrection of Jesus, but there won't be a bodily resurrection. But if to deny a resurrection, you have to deny Jesus' resurrection. But if you believe in Jesus' resurrection, then why would you deny the future resurrection? You see how he's doing that. So verse 12, as I mentioned to you, is critical in 1 Corinthians 15. He goes through these consequences in verses, this rhetorical device there in verses 12 through 19, where he says, you know, if Jesus wasn't raised, then we're false witnesses, you're still in your sin, those who've died have no hope, etc. Okay. So then we come to verse 20, and in verse 20 he says, but now, in contrast to that, that's a logical now, not chronological. It's like, okay, we've talked about that, but aren't we glad that's not the case? You know, so he says, but now Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who are asleep. I know we've been over this, but I really want you to get as we move on into the latter part of 1 Corinthians 15. Who are those who are asleep? There you go. The ones who have died. That's right, Brother Hale. And in fact, this isn't the only time you get that language. 1 Thessalonians 4 talks about those who are asleep in Jesus. That's language for, you know, Christians who've passed on. And so he says in verse 20, if you look at it, Christ has been raised from the dead, but he says Jesus is the first fruits of those who are asleep. The implication being those who have died and those who are on the earth have hope. And he's going to go on and say, if you look at that verse and look at the connection, you have first fruits, who would be the harvest? Us, yeah, the Christians, future bodily resurrection. Okay, so remember we talked about the significance of first fruits and harvest language throughout the Bible. If there's not a connection between the two in kind, in nature, I mean, if there's just no connection, why would he be talking about Jesus? He's just talked about Jesus' resurrection, the first 11 verses. Now he's saying he's the first fruits, and he's saying there's going to be a future harvest. And he even says in the verse, he talks about those who've already died in the Lord. So, the point being, we have a lot of reason to rejoice as Christians when we think about the future bodily resurrection in light of what we know about Jesus, because he's the first fruits. Okay. Now, we worked through verses 24 through 28, and then we're going to pick up in 35. Was there anything left over, if you can even remember back that far, was there anything left over in verses 24 through 28 that you wanted to talk about? Because that's, for some, that's been a challenging section, but I think if you leave it in the context, it makes sense. Okay, so he talks about verse 23, each one in his own order, Christ the first fruits. Again, after that, those who are Christ at his coming. So he's talking about God's people. He says, then comes the end when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father, when he has abolished all rule and all authority and power. So Jesus is in a position of authority and power. We know that, right? As head of the church, as the leader of God's people, and that power and authority has been given to him according to this text by who? The Father. Okay, so it's just they're equal in their nature. Remember this, Father, Son, Spirit, equal in nature, but in function they have different function, right? We knew that. So, you know, the Father wills it, Jesus executes the will, Holy Spirit is the revealing active agent in that way. Okay, so this is the same stuff. Verse 25, for he must reign, that's Jesus, until he has put all the enemies under his feet. Who does he say are the enemies? This is important for 1 Corinthians 15. Who are the enemies? Death and sin. That's right. Death and sin. And so, now what I want you to do here, okay, I want you to realize those connections. Okay, sin and death, not just death, sin and death. Why does it seem those things are connected? What'd you say? Okay. They know that's brilliant. It sounds a lot like what I thought. You're right. They are connected, and I know what you mean. They are connected because of what Roger said. One is the cause and the other is the effect, though. Now, later on, we laugh now, but later on, we'll see if y'all stick to your guns on this, okay? I hope you do. So, sin is a catalyst. It's the means that brought death into the world. God did not create man with this problem. God created man, and he was absolutely good, and sin came in, which is what you are referring to, and death is the effect. We've talked about that many times in our Bible studies. Okay. That's right. That's right. Adam brought, yeah, he opened the door, didn't he? With his, Adam and Eve opened up the door. But as we read through, we're going to see a contrast between man's present condition and man's future condition. And if you realize that God, prior to sin, God created man good. The resurrection is a means of restoring man to the way God made him. Okay? We'll come back to that. But I just want you to keep that in mind. So in verse 25, he says, he'll reign until he has put his enemies under his feet. This is God's purpose. The last enemy that will be abolished is death. For he has put all things in subjection under his feet. So God the Father put everything under Jesus' feet. But when he says, all things are put in subjection, it is evident that he, the Father, is accepted. He's excluded from being under the feet of Jesus always. Who put all things in subjection to him. So, you know, that makes sense, doesn't it? The Father is the one that put everything under the feet of Jesus. So the only one that's not under the feet of Jesus in that sense would be the Father in this context. So then in verse 28, when all things are subjected to him, that is, death and sin has been vanquished and all of those things, then the Son himself also will be subjected to the one who subjected all things to him. Now that, I know you go, okay, what's he saying? Verse 28, at the end, Jesus, this doesn't have to do with whether or not he's divine. Of course, he's divine. But in his relationship to the Father, in his function, what does the text say? In eternity, he'll be what to the Father? Yeah, he'll be in subjection. So Jesus rules and reigns, but when sin and death are conquered, he's going to turn the kingdom, which is God's people, he's going to, as if he's presenting the kingdom back to God. And death and sin have been conquered. Imagine this like a play or a story. There's restoration at the very end. This is the last scene. There's restoration. And Jesus himself is willing to be subject to the Father in eternity. In other words, his ruling, I'll get you in just a minute. His ruling and his reigning in the capacity that he was ruling and reigning has accomplished its end. Okay? He doesn't cease to be divine. That has to do with nature. So, But as far as his office, as far as his office as ruling in this position, well, now death and sin have been vanquished. And so Jesus himself, while he continues to be divine, is going to be subject to the Father. And let me give you one more for call on Billy. Romans 8, I think it's verses 29 and 30, would mention that Jesus is the firstborn of many brethren. Now, firstborn means preeminent. But that's interesting because that's the same chapter that talks about us being conformed to his image. And while there's a sense in which right now we're conformed to his image, I think that's talking about the ultimate sense through the resurrection and the connection between him and us in the resurrection. Okay, that's kind of heavy, but chew on it a little bit. Billy, go ahead. Right. That's right. Some commentators, and I kind of like this, you have to think about it a little bit. We use the phrase already but not yet. And you go, what? That's a lot of somebody struggling there. Already but not yet. But what he means is, to what Billy is saying, as a Christian, my view as a Christian is we still struggle against sin, but we've been freed from the dominion of sin by God's grace already. Okay, but the full implications of all of that, which would be the future bodily resurrection, okay, the redemption of not only the soul, but also the body, Romans 8, verses 23, well, I guess 23 and 24, that he will redeem the redemption of our body, that's not yet, but it's certain for us. We know that's going to happen. The world may not know it's going to happen. But, in other words, there's a transformation of the soul, which happens in conversion and as we continue to grow closer and closer to Christ. But then there is the redemption of the body in the future resurrection. This is Paul's point. If you believe Jesus was raised, that's the foundation of your spiritual resurrection when you're baptized into Christ. The old man's put to sin, the new man's raised to walk in newness of life. He's still not done. There's going to be a redemption of the body, a future resurrection. So as much grief and agony and loss as we have in this life, we're in a condition that some call already but not yet. We know it's going to happen. We rejoice that it's going to happen. We understand it hasn't happened yet in the, you know, in the stream of time, but it will. We've experienced two of the three. One, we believe that Jesus was raised. Two, we've been raised from spiritual death in Christ. And there's a third that's coming. So we're in a condition of already but not yet, but we're certain of God's promises. Okay, go ahead. That's right. I would agree with that. Now, let me back you up a little bit and let's talk, work through some of it. There is some question for some regarding the nature of the Godhead. Was there a change in the functioning within the Godhead? I don't think there's ever been a change in the functioning of the Godhead. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think if you go back, you think about creation for a minute, you know, we've talked about this, but the Father, there seems to always have been this diversity of function where the Father willed it, and Jesus executes the will. He actually creates, and the Spirit. There's a level of submission in that. Just like with redemption, God sent Jesus. You know, the Father sent Jesus. However, to your point, and I think it is a worthy point, when you think about this sacrifice, or however you want to say it, that Christ made. And we'll talk more about this. He's in a glorified state, but I don't think, and if some of you go, oh, I don't know about that, just hang on with me. Let's work through 1 Corinthians 15 and some other passages. While Jesus, we understand in the incarnation, Jesus is divine and human, right? I don't think that stopped when he ascended back to the Father. Now, I think it would be glorified humanity, but I don't think he just threw everything away and everything went back to the way it was before, which I think is your point, Todd. That this was this change, if you will, while he didn't stop being divine, he became something he would never cease to be. He's incarnate and he's been glorified. And I know we're going to talk about verse 50 eventually in 1 Corinthians 15 about flesh and blood. But I just want, to Todd's point, there is something there in verses 24 through 28 that indicates, and I can't explain all of it, but that indicates that when Jesus presents this back, there's now he is going to be subject to the Father in the fullest sense of the word, and he's fulfilled the point in his office and capacity. And now death and sin have been vanquished. And what a thought that the Son of God would be subject to the Father in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I think.
Yeah.
His sacrifice on that day, that Friday,
was just the beginning.
It just didn't stop.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, you have to think about his mediation, too, as mediator. In order to be our mediator, what does the mediator have to be able to do? That's right. If Todd and I have an issue, and yeah, she might take my side though. But that's right. It'd be like him saying, "Okay, well, Karen's going to be the mediator." Well, I might say, "Well, wait a minute. I don't know if she's as neutral in this as I." But here's the deal: a true mediator equally partakes of the nature of both parties they represent. Okay, we understand that. When we think about Jesus being our mediator, Jesus alone really is truly qualified to be our mediator because he equally partakes of the nature of both parties he represents. If he didn't, he couldn't fulfill that mediation. Everybody with me on that? Okay, so we'll come back to that. Just hang on to it. But verses 24 through 28 is very encouraging and interesting and kind of challenging, but that's what the text says. It says the Son will be subject to the Father. We know that he's the firstborn among many brethren. We are his brethren. And that we're going to be transformed into his likeness. That doesn't mean we become divine. But it will say that we're going to have a glorified body, that we will be glorified, that we will be transformed in the fullest sense, in the fullest sense of the term. Okay. Anybody got a question? Go ahead, Tom. And then I'll come back to you, Roger. It's okay. Well, I have had that question through the years. It tends to, this question, how are the dead raised after their bodies have decomposed? That's an interesting question you ask. Of course, Christians ask it from a different perspective, you know. Well, they might say, there are some people, let me give you an example, like, and I've mentioned them before, but we're called preterists or 80-70 doctrine folks. Who deny, they say they believe Jesus is the Son of God. They even believe Jesus was raised, but they don't believe there's going to be a future resurrection. Okay. So they might say, hey, there's just no way we really see material bodies being raised after they've decomposed, you know, so they deny the resurrection. Okay. They might ask a question. Sometimes brethren ask the question, not necessarily because they're in full denial. They're just trying to figure things out. Okay. But you are right. If you think about, especially here in the West, we live in a very materialistic, but also when you think of atheists, it's very naturalistic. When you hear the word naturalistic, people are saying the only thing we have is what we can touch. There's no soul, spirit stuff. So this silliness Christians are talking about resurrection. I mean, what is that? So I think some of Paul's line of argumentation is worthwhile for that too. Is that kind of what you're asking me?
Yeah, I was just a convert to
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Well, to your point, and I think, and we'll talk about it here in a minute, and we mentioned this last week, but Paul basically makes two arguments to answer this kind of naturalistic view that it couldn't happen. One is, he does use analogies from the natural realm that says, the principle of what I'm talking about, you really see it on a regular basis. So to act like that just couldn't happen at all, well, you don't really, you don't even believe your own argument. In other words, you're making an argument about spiritual things, but you do it all the time. You put seed in the ground, it decays, life comes forth, plant looks different, has different attributes, but they're connected. So that's one way. The other thing he's going to do is to your point that you're making is, let's talk about, as a Christian, I believe in the God who made all things. And to this question, if God made me, he can raise me, you know. So the one who created all forms to suit a particular purpose, whether you're talking about the stars or the moon or the sun or our bodies or animal forms or whatever, can he not fashion us so we can function in the spiritual realm? Sure he can. So, yeah. That's, Roger, what'd you got? Yeah.
You look at his air as human, I think, as man. I mean, is this part of the same thing?
I think so. I think in that context, I'm thinking through Romans 8. Let me show you something. Let's turn over to Romans 8. Yeah, which is interesting because it's a very similar context to what we're looking at in 1 Corinthians 15. But he says in verse 16, the Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him so that we may also be glorified with him. That has to do with his incarnation. But I would argue that, of course, the glorification there is the future resurrection. So, or at least that's part of being transformed like him. I think it's important to recognize none of this would, and you don't mean it this way, none of this would diminish his divinity, but it does emphasize his humanity. It does emphasize his incarnation. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It does, and you need to look at it this way too. It not only emphasizes Jesus, but it's emphasizing who we are as believers. That's what we need to get out of this. That, think about it, he's firstborn among many brethren. You know, sometimes we call him, the Bible doesn't call him our elder brother, but I'm okay with that phrase. It calls him our brother, and certainly that's a way of showing respect. But there's a sense in which there's this likeness. We even sing songs. I meant to pull out some of the hymns. Some of the newer songs that we sing, we'll mention, seems like we had one the other night during singing, but even some of the old hymns talks about having his likeness stamped on us. Can you think of the song? Yeah, say that again, Roger. Yeah, stamp thine own image deep on my heart. Well, there's a sense in which that's talking about conversion, but biblically, there's this hope that we're going to be completely conformed to him in the resurrection. Let me give you a passage, Philippians 3, 20 and 21, who says, I think the old King James says, who shall change our vile body that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body. And in that context, talks about how he's working all these things. So that did you? And that answers Tommy's deal. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's all we
That's all. Well, we're going to get a little bit more into it. In fact, but yeah, you're right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And we'll get into more, but don't look at it in a mechanical way. 1 Corinthians 15 is not meant to say, okay, here's the instruction manual on resurrection. Okay. 1B says, you know, it's not how it, that's not what's going on, to Tommy's point, that there's an aspect of this that if you believe in God, which kind of is what Paul says, isn't it? You believe in God, you believe in Christ, why in the world would you deny the future resurrection? I mean, if you can get to A and B, why couldn't you get to C? Okay. So that's true. But now it does seem like he's making logical arguments, which if we've read Paul before, you know what he sounds like. But he's making logical arguments that says before you decide to dismiss the feasibility of a future resurrection, as people who already believe in Jesus' resurrection, let's work through this a little bit. And so that's kind of what he's doing in chapter 15. He is revealing to us this is what's going to happen. I don't think Paul's intention is to say this is how it's going to happen. His intention is to say this is what is going to happen, which is Tommy's point. As a believer, I know sometimes we want to know the how. There's a lot of things, even about creation, we have the creation account, but there's a lot of how all that happened we might wonder about. But we just go on what happened. It's interesting, God's not so concerned about always telling us how, because if he told us, we probably wouldn't fully understand it anyway. So he just says, this is what's going to happen. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, well, I will. We're going to get there. I don't know if I'll get it, but I've got that written down, Kelson. So that's a good question, though, why that connection, okay? And when we get further into chapter 15, that's going to come out. And we may get to a little bit of it here in just a minute. Okay, anybody else have your hand up? Everybody thoroughly confused now? Okay. All right, so verse 35, which gets to some of these things we've been talking about, he says, but someone will say, how are the dead raised, and with what body do they come? You remember we talked a little bit about this. But let's read verses 35 through 44. Todd, can you read that? Let's just read verses 35 through 44. Okay, thank you. So they ask this question. Let's look at what Paul does with this. They say, how are the dead raised and with what kind of body do they come? Their implication being, there's just no way that can happen. Okay. Verse 36, he starts out with what? What does he say to them? Yeah, he says, you're being foolish. That which you sow, now this is his agricultural argument, that which you sow does not come to life unless it dies. Now, this is a great argument, actually, because what are they arguing? They are arguing, how does this sound familiar? How does life come from death? Any naturalistic materialist today you talk to about resurrection, that's going to be the same question they ask. Maybe for a different reason, but they're going to ask that question. How would you have life coming from death? And so he's going to go on with this. He says, well, you see this all the time. You know, every time you put that seed in the ground, the seed decays, but there's life, there's germ of life in the seed. And let's say whatever plant comes from that seed. And by the way, we know there's particular seeds that produce a certain kind of form or life. And so the plant comes up. And so you see the plant. Does the plant look like the seed? No. Does the plant seem to have different attributes and characteristics? It looks different, doesn't it, than the seed? Do you get the plant without the seed? No. Did life come forth from something decaying? Yes. Okay. So, it's as if, who created the natural realm? God. So now you're saying the God who created the very thing that you see, but you really can't explain all the hows on this either. You have to explain the what, don't you? This is what we know. We observe. Seed dies. Life. Plant. We see it all the time. Okay. And we could get more minute about that, but that's just his basic idea. And so if that happens in the natural realm, why could not the same God who created the natural realm, which they actually say they believe in, do that very thing with our bodies and transform us and there be resurrection? Okay, seems logical. So now who's being foolish? Because this is something you've seen all the time. So the very argument you're making that life can't come from death, you see on a regular basis. Okay? You see, so that's argument number one. Argument number two is going to be, back to the thing we've been talking about, is you need to realize that God is creator. And let's look at the diversity of His creation. And God has a purpose for every form. The reason the bird is functioning the way he does is because of its form. The reason the moon and the sun and the stars function the way they do is because of form. Okay. Now, let's look again. So he makes this argument in 36 and 37, then look at 38. But God gives it a body or a form just as he wished, whatever is according to his purpose. And to each of the seeds a body of its own. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one flesh of men and another flesh of beasts and another flesh of birds and another of fish. There are also heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is one and the glory of the earthly is another. There is one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon and another glory of the stars, for star differs from star in glory. Now his only point is God has purposes for everything he does, and he designed these forms to function in a way that is in harmony with their purpose. Okay? Bear with me. Now, why do God, we have earthly form, earthly bodies. And those earthly bodies function in a particular realm, earthly realm. Okay. We're going to be changed. And, you know, sometimes when you get into, for instance, later on here in chapter 15, if you look at verse 44, we're going to talk more about this, but he talks about a spiritual body and a natural body. And people, I think we let Hollywood influence us way too much. We get this idea of a heavenly body. It's this ghostly, you know, thing. People are shoving their hands. That's not what he's talking about. We're going to have a body. Let me just disabuse us of any thought that we're not going to have any body in the heavenly realm. Okay. We're going to have a body. It's not going to be exactly like this. Is going to be changed. This is going to be transformed. But nonetheless, what I want you to see is when he's talking about an earthly body, a body suited to function here. A heavenly body is a body suited to function in the spiritual realm. Okay? Now, what exactly? I have 5 minutes. Thank you. What all the details of that as far as how that happens, I don't know, and I'm not worried about knowing that part. There's a lot of things I don't know the how of, but the what is revealed. Don't tell me that nothing said about what will happen, because he's telling us the what. All right. Now, so he says, we understand these principles. God is creator, and the principle of life coming from death in the natural realm. Verse 42. So also is the resurrection of the dead. He says, it. Now tell me, what is it? The body. What body? This body. Okay? I want you to understand that Paul does not argue there's this body and then he just scraps that thing and he's going to create a whole different body. That's just not what resurrection is. There's a change. There's a change. There's a transformation. But it is resurrection. And so he says, so also is the resurrection of the dead. Its body is sown a perishable or corruptible body. Now let's go back to what we said earlier. Why is this body corruptible? Or perishable? Or decaying? Or decomposing? Because of sin. I'm going to say that real slow again. Because of sin. This is not necessarily Paul saying, okay, we have a material body now, but then we will have no body. That is not what he says. Okay? We read that into the context. You don't get that out of Paul. That's not what he's saying. So, what is he saying? Well, let's go back. Let me ask you this, and I don't want to get off the subject. I just want you to think about it. We can talk about it next week if you want. Prior to sin, did Adam have a body? Yes. The corruptible nature, the decaying, decomposing nature of that body happened because of what? Sin. Just stick that away somewhere. Okay. We'll come back to that next week. Now, back in chapter 15, he says, it is sown a perishable or corruptible body, but he says, it is raised an imperishable or incorruptible body. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. We can appreciate that, can't we? With death. But he says, it is raised in power. It's immortal. It's not subject to death. Why? Sin has been defeated. Death has been defeated. He says, it is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. Now listen. And you don't have to know Greek to know this, but I will say this. The word for spirit or spiritual is pneuma. That's why you have spiritual if you just look in your Bible. Soma, we sometimes hear about disorders that are somatic. Soma is body. He's not saying there's no body. He's saying there is this body that dies will be changed into a spiritual body. That is a body that now is not subject to death and suffering and sin. Okay? He's not saying there will be no body. He says there will be a body, but it won't be subject to sin. It won't be subject to death. It won't be subject to suffering. It'll be able to function in the spiritual realm, in absolute communion with God, in His immediate presence, which is amazing. Okay. So, we're going to start next week, I promise, no long review. We're going to start back in verse 42. But please do this for me, okay? We've got a full week. At least read 42 through 58. I want you to remember two things. Remember the sin and death correlation we talked about. They go together. And I want you to think about verse 50, but I want you to ask yourself, how does the New Testament use flesh and blood when you see that whole phrase? He doesn't just say flesh, he says flesh and blood. What might he be talking about? Okay? All right. Sin, death, and remember flesh and blood. We'll stop there.